Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. We have a really power-packed show today. We're going to talk about just going on a vacation can change gene activity. This is from the Icahn Institute of Genomics and Multiscale Biology. That means when we go on a vacation, we're actually changing our DNA. Also, a study shows that a vegetarian blood is 800% more effective at killing cancer cells than a meat eater's. That's good to know, but there's more. And students going vegan, and it's helping colleges trim the fat. So we'll talk about what's happening across American college campuses. And something that's a little technical, but I'll boil it into lay language, how our neurons talk to each other. From the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry, and more on health and healing. Then today, an original in-depth investigative reporting white paper. It is up on our website. In fact, we will see that it's posted at the top of the website again, because throughout the day it goes down on Facebook, and you can get it on progressivereadernetwork.com, The Toxic Science of Flu Vaccines. Now, this is especially prevalent when people are thinking that their pharmacist, the nurse, the doctor is knowing best when it comes to helping them prevent the flu. Are they really preventing the flu? Are they putting mercury into the body? Is this neurotoxic? Do they have any science on their side that's legitimate to prove their point? This investigative report will lay that bare. And then today, another part of my series of open letters to Michael Moore. Michael's been a friend for a long time, and he is now actively, aggressively pursuing the attacks on Trump, but also the promotion of Hillary Clinton as the answer to all of our problems. And so I'm trying to show that, though I respect his point of view as far as what he's done in many of his movies, like Sicko, he was right on that. And Where Should We Invade Next? And Capitalism, a Love Story. These are absolutely the opposite of everything Hillary Clinton believes in and what her policies have shown. So she's not going to change anything for Michael Moore. But I'm going to add more to it today. So Michael, today, we're going to hear from one of the brightest, most respected journalists in the world, John Pilger. Inside the Invisible Government: War Propaganda and the Clinton and Trump Machines. Then we're going to hear about the real reason that Hillary Clinton caused the invasion of Gaddafi, the murder of tens of thousands of citizens and displacement of millions. And it's from an original investigative report by one of the most respected people I know in journalism, F. William Ingdahl. Hillary, the emails, the golden ears, and the Arab Springs. Information that no one has known till this point. A lot of original material here. So you're going to get the lowdown on that, and that's coming from the emails, from their own emails. And then from Mother Jones, the Kern issue, how Hillary Clinton's State Department sold fracking to the world. A trove, quote, of secret documents detail the U.S. government's global push for shale gas. And who was the leading person pushing it? Hillary Clinton. So Mother Jones, and Michael used to work for Mother Jones. So are you really saying you're going to advocate for gas hydrofracking around the world? Because if that's the case, then we also have to look at you supporting the government and the private industry against the Native Americans who don't want their land hydrofracked. They don't want the pipes from the oil going across their land, including their sacred burial grounds. So we're going to deal with these in depth. Let's begin. We have a full show. Just going on a vacation, that simple, is enough to get a completely new type of gene activity. That's according to the latest research they've done. And this new study comparing meditation retreats with just relaxing in the same locale. Both options improve stress regulation and immune function and other cellular markers in the blood. Researchers measured gene activity, meaning blood markers, and reported well-being during the vacation and months afterwards, and found a large and immediate vacation effect in all participants. For those who continued meditating, benefits were seen 10 months after they returned. Quote, vacation is a relaxing, resort-like environment, or in that environment, takes you away from your day-to-day grind, which may be high stress, in which your body is in a more defensive-like posture. With pressures to meet deadlines and dealing with angry customers and battling with colleagues for resources to accomplish your mission or whatever. That's what the lead researcher, Dr. Eric Schmed, said on this. On a relaxing vacation, you allow your body to get out of that defensive posture, reducing your levels of stress, which in turn affects the state of cells that are involved in your immune system. What does this mean? It means at your molecular level, additional changes only happen more in the meditative group. So two people both going on a vacation. One is on the vacation and meditating. The other is just enjoying the vacation. They both have improvements in de-stressing, but one actually has molecular changes. Quote, we don't know what this means exactly, but given associations with biomarkers of aging, there's the potential that these changes could enhance overall well-being and longevity, end quote. So, let me put this into a little broader perspective. One of the reasons that I've always, in my adult life, lived on a farm or a ranch, upstate New York for 16 years, on Lake Apakong for 5 years, down in west, northwest Texas, near the Rio Grande River at the Healing Springs Ranch for 8 years, living in Florida for over 20 years, all ranches, self-sustained environments. One reason is because I realized the power of nature in rebalancing your energy. Just being around trees. In fact, with my caretaker today, early this morning, I sent a video, and the video was from, I believe, Australia, and it showed that a group of ducks, about 1,000 ducks, walking down the street, kind of running down the street, and they go right past all these people's homes, and they go into the vineyards, and they spend their day joyfully eating insects. Hence, the vineyards are not sprayed. They don't have to be, because the different insects that would normally affect the grapes, the grape leaves, the grape vines, are eaten. And that's terrific. I have guinea hens and chickens. These are all rescues, meaning if I didn't rescue them, they'd have been eaten. But now they can live out their life in a beautiful, wonderful natural environment. They go out in the morning. They come back at night. They're locked in at night so the bobcats, mountain lions don't eat them. But during the daytime, they just are everywhere eating. And guess what? You don't see the ticks, the spiders, the scorpions, because that's the meal. So when you see little things that other people never experience, and you're just able to sit by a pond and watch fish, just watch them living in harmony, and you get to a point where the fish will actually eat out of your hand, there's a vibration you're sharing with nature, and the respondents are very balanced. That de-stresses, that calms. Then you come back into the city, and you're met with this kind of hyper-frenetic energy where everything changes. It speeds up. And yet, because you've been slowed down and relaxed and meditative, you're not all upset about it. Most people really regret Mondays because they've had a chance to unwind or socialize or party on Saturday and Sunday. So that's what it's saying. We need more time for meditative relaxation. And I believe the most important retreats in the future will be meditation retreats. Yeah, you can do yoga and other things, but going into that meditative state is what really helps you. Vegetarian blood is 800% more effective at killing cancer cells. This is from True Activist. Quote, eschewing animal products isn't only good for the planet. It improves your odds of living a long and healthy life. At present, 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women in the United States will develop cancer in their lifetimes. Furthermore, the number of cancer cases is expected to double in the near future. Obviously, this news is distressing. However, there is hope, and the solution could be as simple as eating more unprocessed plant-based foods. According to this study, scientists have learned that blood taken from vegans is 800% more effective at killing cancer cells than blood taken from those following a standard American diet. This was published in Collective Evolution. And so they had their blood taken before and during and after, and then measuring the cancer cells in a petri dish, and boy, the vegetarian diet made a difference. Now I'll go one step further. I worked with the Seventh-day Adventist Church in White Plains. And my rule for working with a church group, any religious group, which I'm happy to do and have, is that the entire congregation, starting with the whoever heads the church, the rabbi or the imam or the minister, preacher, they have to be a part of it because they're the focal point of authority in that church. And this one in White Plains had the entire congregation. They were almost all African American. They all had health problems, and we filmed it. So every week for 6 months, I would meet with them and share insights. We had our team, Luann Panessi, Dr. Martin Feldman, and we worked with them. Now, this is just lifestyle behavior modification, nothing medical. At the end of 6 months, there had been a massive loss of weight. People were diabetic, were no longer diabetic. People had aches and pains and fatigue, no longer had them. People that had normally gone through a flu season ended up with flu once or twice, colds, had none. We had people who came up and said, I came here. If you look on your camera, the first meeting, I was on crutches because of the pain and stiffness in my knees because of arthritis. Doctors said nothing could heal it. And look at me. I've lost over 65 pounds, and they were all on a vegan diet. And they were there to support each other. So I've seen the power of this diet. Now, that's a healthy vegan diet. You can also have an unhealthy vegan diet. You can have an unhealthy vegetarian diet. Mind you, if you just ate white bread all day, you're vegan, but it's not healthy. But it's the amount of raw foods, living foods, that you put into that diet. And then the quality of the supplementation. So when you're juicing a lot and you're having a lot more fresh herbs and vegetables in your diet, you go to an entirely different level of health. And that's what they've yet to do. We've done it, and then they reached out to the National Seventh-day Adventist Association, but we never heard back from them. We thought it'd be really nice to have a nationwide program of all different Seventh-day Adventist congregations working together in a program. Maybe that day will come. And now, following up on that, students are going vegan more and more. A major group of universities and colleges are offering meat and dairy-free menus in their dining halls. Quote from Take Part, what's serving up in college cafeterias became a hot topic this summer thanks to an episode of writer Malcolm Caldwell's podcast, Revisionist History. Then they went in to argue about all the money being spent on schools putting in fancy foods on the menu, like lobster bakes and venison, instead of offering financial aid to low-income students. But another trend in campus dining halls that Gladwell might want to take a look at in a future episode is one that could hold down college food costs, vegan meal options. According to a survey released Tuesday, the youth division of the group found that meat and dairy-free items have become one of the hottest things on college cafeterias' menus. They surveyed 1,500 four-year colleges and universities in the United States and found 62%, that's 6-2, offered vegan menus on a daily basis. That's up from 28% just 2 years ago. That's a huge increase. The survey also found that about 9% of schools, private institutions like American University in Washington, D.C., and public state schools like University of California, San Diego, have entirely vegan dining stations. So the vegan revolution is on. In fact, the 36,000-student University of North Texas has had a 300-seat all-vegan dining facility since 2011. After the school installed the vegan dining hall, quote, meal plan sales rose by 20% while operating costs remained comparable. So, there we have it. One of the biggest movements in America is getting no media attention at all, going vegan on college campuses. And that's a good thing. And finally, how neurons talk to each other. Now, it's a little esoteric, but I'll explain it and why it's important. This is from the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry. Quote, neurons are connected to each other through synapses, sites where signals are transmitted in the form of chemical messengers. Our nervous system consists of about 100 billion interlinked neurons that are capable of carrying out complex computations. Each neuron, each one of these 100 billion, has an antenna zone comparable to the cell body and its extension, what are called the dendrites. It is here it receives signals from other neurons. What's this mean? It means that one cell talks, the other cell listens. The signals are then computed and forwarded to a cable, the axon, in the form of electrical impulses. In the emitter region, the axon branches to form contact sites known as synapses, where the signals are transmitted to other neurons. At the synaptic site, electrical impulses arrive from the axon are converted into chemical signals. The information then flows in only one direction. One cell talks, the other listens. The number of synapses that a single neuron can develop varies considerably. Depending upon its type, a neuron can have anything from just one to 100,000 synapses. Now, on average, each neuron has around 1,000 synapses. So, what do we learn? We learn the nerve ending of the transmitter, the presynaptic neuron, and all these are communicating. Now, why is this important? I won't go any further because it's just too technical. However, here's what it means. When you are talking kindly to someone, when you're talking softly to someone, the brain is picking up this message, this communication, this vibration, and it's then registering that, and it's then able to communicate that from the neuron through the synaptics to the other cell. The cell's listening, and then it's given not just listening to it, it's understanding what the message is, even though it's an electronic message. It then vibrates this out throughout the body. Hence, when we're in a relaxing environment, our brain is telling us, relax. When we're in an exciting environment, our brain is calling for excitement. So the brain is interpreting all the stimulus in our life, from holding hands and a warm kiss, to an embrace and a cuddle, to looking at someone and appreciating the fact that we're being appreciated. All of these are signals to the brain, and all of these have an outcome. We record that, and we store it. And then one day, a picture that we see, something pops in our mind, and immediately the brain starts giving you all of these playbacks. And that's why when we're in loving relationships, not demeaning, not usurious, where we can trust the energy we're receiving from the other persons, whoever they may be, teachers, parents, friends, loved ones, it makes us feel at ease. And in that at ease, we're not secreting adrenaline. We're not secreting cortisol. We're not secreting the stress hormones, which prematurely age us and actually kill us, cause disease. So we may think the brain is primitive, anything but. It's extremely sophisticated. Remember I told you once that everything in life is simply an exchange of energy. I've not gone into that. At the retreats, I do go into that, but I have not gone that on the air because it would take 3 or 4 hours to fully explain it. But I'll just give you an overarching concept. Everything we do in life, before we do it, before we speak it, before we act on it, there's a split second where we can stop and say, how would I feel on the receiving end of what I'm about to get? So think about that next time before you yell at someone or mean to someone, vulgar at someone, because that's going to create a permanent vibration that's going to be locked into that neuron and all those synapses. And that's why a lot of people have grown up in environments that were not loving and not nurturing and not caring. And so they become highly defensive. They constrict their energy. Their energy is not an open, strong vibration. It is a tightly wound vibration. And their ego is always jumping ahead of what they're thinking and saying. And as a result, they self-sabotage. What they want, they don't get. And what they fear, they create. So remember, how your neurons talk to each other is based upon what impact the neurons had based upon the stimulus they were receiving. So if we can do something kinder, gentler, with humor, it's always good for the brain, which is good for the body. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. The toxic science of flu vaccines. Joshua Hadfield was a normal, healthy, developing child as a toddler. In the midst of the 2010 H1N1 flu vaccine frenzy and fear-mongering about the horrible consequences children face if left unvaccinated, had Joshua vaccinated with GlaxoSmithKline's influenza vaccine. Within weeks, Joshua could barely wake up, sleeping up to 19 hours a day. Laughter would even trigger seizures. Joshua was diagnosed with narcolepsy, an incurable debilitating condition associated with acute brain damage. Today, we can look back at that Pandemrix as a horrible vaccine. Research indicates that it was associated with a 1,400% increase in narcolepsy risk. More recently, a team of Finnish scientists at Finland's National Institutes of Health and Welfare recorded 800 cases of narcolepsy associated with this vaccine. Vaccine ingredients other than the engineered viral antigen are most often believed to be the primary culprits in adverse vaccine reactions. The Finnish research, on the other hand, indicated that the vaccine's altered viral nucleotide likely contributed to the sudden rise in sleeping sickness. Now, although this vaccine was pulled from the market, it should never have been approved and released in the first place. This is a classic case of regulatory negligence by health officials in the World Health Organization, which promulgates flu vaccines around the world. Now, like all vaccines, which are now commonly fast-tracked through government health regulatory agencies for rapid release upon the public, it should have been tested more thoroughly and more rigorously reviewed. Since the time of Edward Jenner's primitive inoculation experiments to combat smallpox and its countless aftermaths of death throughout the 19th century, modern vaccine science has failed to learn its lessons. The failure of proper regulatory oversight has resulted in Joshua and other British citizens becoming disabled for life. The British government has paid out over £63 million to cover lawsuits from just that one vaccine alone. Glaxo has never admitted its flu vaccine caused brain damage, and this begs the question as to why it was withdrawn, since it was the corporation's single flagship vaccine against the swine flu. We shouldn't become complacent by assuming flu vaccine risks only affect young children. Sarah was 20 years old after receiving the FluVac shot. 3 weeks later, her health deteriorated dramatically. She was diagnosed with extraordinarily challenging neurological condition, a not uncommon adverse effect of influenza vaccination. 4 years later, Sarah remains paralyzed from the waist down, incapable of dressing and feeding herself, and rotting away in hospitals and nursing homes. Joshua and Sarah's stories are by no means unique. Today, tens of thousands of infants and toddlers and children and adults across the nation are increasingly becoming victims of vaccine injuries. No national debate is initiated because regulatory malfeasance within the federal health agencies has aligned itself to the interest of the pharmaceutical profit incentive rather than serving the public health. Flu vaccines are perhaps the most ineffective vaccine on the market. Repeatedly, we are told by health officials that the moral argument for its continued use is the greater good, meaning the herd protection, though that's never been proven, by the way. Although this is imaginary as a good, it has certainly never been defined scientifically. For the present 2016 flu season, the CDC has removed MedImmune's live attenuated flu vaccine, Flu Mist, from the market because it was found to be ineffective, or at least this is the rationale stated by the agency. According to the CDC, 1/3 of the children's influenza vaccinations are with live nasal sprays. Yet regardless of how ineffective and useless Flu Mist has been, it has remained on the market since 2003. And in 2014, the CDC recommended it as a flu vaccine of choice for children. But where was their science supporting that? They had none. Although last year, Flu Mist was only 3% effective. Well, let's reverse it. Last year, Flu Mist was 97% ineffective. That's according to a special report, and the real truth behind its withdrawal is likely more crucial. There is no reason to doubt that the vaccine contributed to more cases of flu infection than it prevented. And this is a fundamental flaw with all live vaccines, and even killed attenuated ones, that have been shown to shed and infect people in contact with the vaccinated persons, especially those with compromised immune systems. Or put into another light, imagine that your child has a Flu Mist vaccine sprayed in their nose. They go home, and for the next 2 weeks to a month, they're shedding live virus out of their nose. They rub their hands across their nose, then they touch silverware, they touch doorknobs. Now everyone in that family could be infected because of that shedding. The same is true for schools, and yet no precaution is told, no precaution is offered, and as a result, cross-contamination could be extraordinary. In her investigative report, The Emerging Risks of Live Virus and Virus Vectored Vaccines, Barbara Lowe Fisher notes that the attenuated virus in the flu vaccine can shed and infect others for months after vaccination. Both the unvaccinated and vaccinated are at risk. The CDC acknowledges this risk and warns, quote, persons who care for severely immunosuppressed persons who require a protective environment should not receive the LAIV vaccine or should avoid contact with such persons for 7 days after receipt, given the theoretical risk for transmission of the live attenuated vaccine virus, end quote. It's not theoretical. It is real. At their best, flu vaccines remain around 50 to 60% effective, according to official health statements. However, the World Health Organization's predictions for 2014-2015 flu strains were a bust. They were wrong. The match was such a failure that the CDC was forced to warn the American public that the vaccine was, quote, only 23% effective. Now, given that the 2012-13 flu season was only 27% effective for 65 years age plus, predictive methodologies to determine which flu strains emerged during any given influenza season have more in common with medieval divination than sound science. For the 1992-93 and 97-98 seasons, the vaccine concoction of flu strains was only 16% effective. Catherine Severin, who monitors the actual World Health Organization predictions and compares them with CDC claims, has stated that, quote, depending upon the study cited, flu vaccine efficacy actually ranges from a low of 0%. But I would challenge all statistics on vaccines. Let me give you an example. If you were in a health support group and there were 500 of you, and I suggested that you change your diet and exercise and start juicing and give up junk foods and take vitamin C, and at the end of a year, 50% of you no longer came down with the colds or flus you normally would, could I then say that vitamin C was responsible for preventing 50% of colds and flu in a season? No, I could not, because it wouldn't be accurate. So if it wouldn't be accurate to give claim of a positive outcome for the use of a nutrient, how is it positive to say, well, if we gave 1,000 people the flu vaccine and 23% of them came down with the flu and the rest did not, then it's 77% effective? That's complete nonsense. There is no science to support that. Because what if a person started going out in the sun more? What if they were on medications they got rid of? What if they started eating better? What if they started to exercise? What if they were not in a relationship, were depressed and lonely, which increases your likelihood of coming down with cold and flu, and now they had a healthy relationship? There's so many variables to determine your status of your immunity at any given time. You cannot then give the credit to a vaccine when you did not come down with the condition. It is completely bad science. It is quack science. And yet that is the entirety of the science that is used today. A Dr. David Brownstein was noted for stating that in the Journal of the American Medical Association report, increased risks of febrile disorders greater than placebo associated with the live vaccine. According to the FDA's literature on flu mist, the vaccine was not studied for immunocompromised individuals, yet was still administered to them and has been associated with acute allergic reactions, including asthma and neurological damage, and a high rate of hospitalizations among children under 24 months of age, largely due to upper respiratory tract infections. Other adverse effects include pericarditis, congenital and genetic disorders, mitochondrial encephalopathic conditions, Lee syndrome, meningitis, and others. These are real disorders due to the vaccine. It's even in their literature. So given this litany of vaccine dangers, it is highly unlikely the vaccine was removed simply for ineffectiveness. And yet when the CDC has never been truthful to the public. For example, if you're saying this vaccine is safe, and yet you're an immunocompromised individual, which millions of Americans are, then every single vaccine will state that if you have an immunocompromised condition, don't get the vaccine. Name me once. One. Show me the person in America that the doctor, the nurse, or the pharmacist says, you know, you have an immunocompromised condition, you shouldn't have this vaccine. So we've been vaccinating people where the literature itself from the vaccine manufacturer says don't do it. So our entire public health policy on vaccination is a sham. It is a fraud. It is a degeneration of everything science should be, but it is very profitable. The development and promotion of the influenza vaccine was never completely about protecting the public. It has been the least popular vaccine in the United States, including among healthcare workers. Instead, similar to the mumps vaccine and the MMR, it has been the cash cow for vaccine makers. Determining the actual severity of any given flu season is burdened by federal intentional confusion to mislead the public. The CDC first line of propaganda defense to enforce flu vaccination is to exaggerate flu infections as the cause of preventable deaths. However, validating this claim is near impossible because the CDC does not differentiate deaths from influenza and deaths due to pneumonia. Well, the vast majority of deaths are from pneumonia, not influenza. On its website, the CDC lumps flu and pneumonia deaths together. Currently, this year, estimated 55,227. The large majority of these, probably over 90%, were pneumonia deaths of elderly patients. Yet any given year, only 3% to 18% maximum of suspected influenza infections actually test positive for type A or type B influenza strain. That means you're bringing it down to in the neighborhood of about 3%. So instead of saying 55,000 people died, say 3% of people, 55,000 died. Well, then suddenly it's not a big health issue as if it were 55. So they lied about the statistics. They're fully aware of what they do. Dr. Martin Meltzer, a CDC expert in health economics, stated, quote, almost nobody dies of the flu, end quote. And, quote, deaths are associated with flu, but not necessarily caused by the flu, which means that unless they're testing you, they may say that you have the flu when you have pneumonia. And that's a big deal. To date, there is only one gold standard clinical trial with a flu vaccine that compares vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And it's not good news for the CDC and the vaccine makers. This Hong Kong-funded double-blind placebo-controlled study followed the health conditions of vaccinated and unvaccinated children between 6 and 15 years for 272 days. The trial concluded the flu vaccine holds no health benefits. In fact, those vaccinated with the flu virus were observed to have a 550% higher risk of contracting non-flu virus respiratory infections. Among the vaccinated children, there was 116 flu cases compared to 88 among unvaccinated. There were 487 other non-influenza virus infections, including rhinovirus, Coxsackie virus, echovirus, and others. Among the vaccinated were 88 with the unvaccinated. The single study alone poses a scientifically sound warning and rationale for avoiding the vaccine. It's worth noting that there are approximately 200 distinct viruses that are misdiagnosed as influenza and produce flu-like symptoms. So if you had the Coxsackie virus, you could have flu-like symptoms. If you had the echovirus or the rhinovirus, you could have flu-like symptoms, but you don't have the flu. So you'd be misdiagnosed. These organisms don't magically appear during fall and winter. They are always with us. Nevertheless, we are more susceptible to flu-like infections during the colder months where there's less daylight hours and hence less vitamin D. In a later study by Dr. Danueta Skowronski in Canada, individuals with a history of receiving consecutive seasonal flu shots were, over several years, had an increased risk of becoming infected with the H1N1 swine flu. Doctor commented on his findings that, quote, policymakers have not yet had a chance to fully digest the study's conclusions or understand the implications. Who knows, frankly? The wise man knows he knows nothing when it comes to influenza, so you always have to be cautious in speculating, end quote. There is strong evidence suggesting that all vaccine clinical trials carried out by manufacturers fall short of demonstrating vaccine efficacy accurately. And when they are shown to be efficacious, it is frequently in the short term and offer only partial or temporary protection. According to an article in the peer-reviewed Journal of Infectious Disease, the only way to evaluate vaccines is to scrutinize the epidemiological data obtained from real-life conditions. In other words, researchers simply cannot or will not adequately test a vaccine's efficacy and immunogenicity prior to its release onto the unsuspecting public. The Cochrane Collaboration, the world's foremost group of unbiased researchers, physicians, and scientists, has performed a series of meta-analyses on the effectiveness of the influenza vaccine. In 2014, they found that vaccinating adults against influenza did not affect the number of people hospitalized nor decrease lost work. Cochrane researchers stated that the results might be overly optimistic due to the fact that 24 out of 90 studies were funded by the vaccine manufacturers, which tend to produce favorable results to their product. According to Dr. Tom Jefferson at the Cochrane Collaboration, it makes little sense to keep vaccinating against seasonal influenza based upon the evidence. Jefferson also endorsed more cost-effective and scientifically proven means of minimizing the transmission of flu, regularly washing your hands throughout the day, and wearing a mask when you're around infected people, plus taking vitamin D. Those are all scientifically proven, not the vaccine. Dr. Jefferson's conclusions are backed by an article by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Dr. Peter Doshi, in the British Journal of Medicine. In his article, Dr. Doshi questions the flu vaccine paradigm, stating, quote, "Closer examination of influenza vaccine policies show that although proponents employ the rhetoric of science, the studies underlying the policy are often of low quality and do not substantiate officials' claims. The vaccine may be less beneficial and less safe than has been claimed, and the threat of influenza appears to be substantially overstated," end quote. And that brings me up to the end of part one. I will complete this tomorrow with part two. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our science report with an original report on this topic of flu vaccines, and we've posted the whole report with all the scientific references on our website. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Soft and sweet and raining. There is a rose in Spanish Harlem.
This is a continuation of my open letter presentation to Michael Moore, the filmmaker. He is a strong advocate for Hillary Clinton's presidency. And that's fine, that's his right. But I'm going to put this into a larger perspective. Because remember, when you vote for someone and you advocate for others voting because of your celebrity status, especially within the liberal community, you have to bear some responsibility for those who would trust that your judgment is sound based upon the research and scholarship that you have offered to support her. Let me share from F. William Engdahl, Michael, a report that should give you pause. Everyone pause. It is entitled Hillary's Emails, Golden Ears in Arab Springs. Quote, "Buried among tens of thousands of pages of former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's secret emails, now being made public by the U.S. government, is a devastating email exchange between Clinton and her confidential advisor, Sid Blumenthal. It's about Gaddafi and the U.S. coordinated intervention in 2011 to topple the Libyan ruler. It's about gold and a potential existential threat to the future of the U.S. dollar as world reserve currency. It's about Gaddafi's plans then for a gold-based denier for Africa in the Arab oil war. Two paragraphs in a recently declassified email from the illegal private server used by then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during the U.S. orchestrated war to destroy Libya's Gaddafi in 2011, reveal a tightly held secret agenda behind the Obama administration's war against Gaddafi, cynically named Responsibility to Protect. Barack Obama, an indecisive and weak president, delegated all presidential responsibility for the Libyan war to a Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Clinton, who has an early backer of an Arab regime change, using the secret Muslim Brotherhood, invoked the new bizarre principle of responsibility to protect to justify the Libyan war, which she quickly turned into a NATO-led war under her responsibility to protect, a silly notion promoted by the networks of George Soros' Open Society foundations, and Clinton claimed with no verifiable proof that Gaddafi was bombing innocent Libyan civilians in the Benghazi region. According to a New York Times report at the time, citing Obama administration senior sources, it was Hillary Clinton, backed by Samantha Power, then a senior aide at the National Security Council, and today Obama's UN ambassador, and Susan Rice, then Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, now National Security Advisor, that triad pushed Obama into military action against Libya's Gaddafi. Clinton, flanked by Powers and Rice, was so powerful that Clinton managed to overrule Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Tom Donilon, Obama's National Security Advisor, and John Brennan, Obama's counterterrorism chief, today CIA head. She had more power. It was her determination. They did not want to invade. She did. They won. Secretary of State Clinton was also knee-deep in the conspiracy to unleash what came to be dubbed as the Arab Spring. Now, until today, until this moment, I doubt that any of the listeners to this program, or to you, Michael, were aware that Hillary Clinton was substantially behind the Arab Spring from the United States' perspective. But she was. In fact, it was the United States and Hillary Clinton's efforts that financed regime changes across the Arab Middle East, part of the Greater Middle East Project unveiled in 2003 by the Bush administration after occupation of Iraq. The first three target countries of the 2011 U.S. Arab Spring action, in which Washington used its human rights NGOs, non-governmental organizations such as Freedom House and the National Endowment for Democracy, in cahoots, as usual, with the Open Society Foundations, a billionaire speculator George Soros, along with U.S. State Department and the CIA operatives, were Ben Ali's Tunisia, Mubarak's Egypt, and Gaddafi's Libya. Now, the timing and targeting of Washington's 2011 Arab Spring destabilizations of select Middle East states assumes a new light in relation to just-released declassified Clinton emails in her private Libya advisor and friend, Sid Blumenthal. Blumenthal is the slick lawyer who defended then-President Bill Clinton in the Monica Lewinsky and other sex scandal affairs when Bill was president facing impeachment. For many, it remains a mystery as why Washington decided that Gaddafi personally must be destroyed, murdered, not just sent into exile like Mubarak. Hillary Clinton, when informed of Gaddafi's brutal murder by U.S.-financed al-Qaeda and the terrorist that she was supporting and funding and arming, told CBS News in a sick, joking paraphrase of Julius Caesar, quote, "We came, we saw, he died." Words spoken by her with a hearty, macabre laugh. Little is known in the West about what Muammar Gaddafi did in Libya, or for that matter in Africa and in the Arab world. Now, release of a new portion of Hillary's emails as Secretary of State at the time she was running Obama's administration war on Gaddafi sheds dramatic new light on the background. It was not a personal decision of Hillary Clinton to eliminate Gaddafi and destroy his entire state infrastructure, causing millions, tens of millions, to be displaced, killing over 50,000, including men, women, and children. That's all Hillary Clinton and Summers and Powers. The decision is now clear. It came from circles very high in U.S. money oligarchy. She was merely another Washington political tool implementing the mandate of those oligarchs. The intervention was about killing Gaddafi's well-laid plans to create a gold-based African and Arabic currency to replace the dollar in oil trades. Since the United States dollar abandoned gold exchange for dollars in 1971, the dollar in terms of gold was dramatically lost in value. Arab and African OPEC oil states have long objected to the vanishing purchasing power of their oil sales, mandated since the 1970s by Washington to the solely use of U.S. dollars, as dollar inflation soared more than 2,000% since 2001. In a newly declassified Clinton email from Sid Blumenthal to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton dated April 2, 2011, Blumenthal reveals the reason that Gaddafi must be eliminated, using the pretext of cited an unidentifiable, quote, high source. Blumenthal writes to Clinton, quote, "According to sensitivity of information available to this source, Gaddafi's government holds 143 tons of gold and a similar amount of silver. This gold was accumulated prior to the current rebellion and was intended to be used to establish a pan-African currency based on the Libyan gold dinar. This plan was designed to provide the Francophone African countries with an alternative to the French franc." End quote. That French aspect was only the tip of the iceberg for Gaddafi. During the first decade of this century, Gulf Arab OPEC countries, including Saudi Arabia and Cotter and others began seriously diverting a significant portion of their revenues from their vast oil and gas sales in state sovereign wealth funds, mainly based on the success of Norway's oil fund. Growing discontent with the U.S. war on terror, with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and with overall U.S. Middle East policies after September 2001, led most OPEC Arab states to divert a growing share of oil reserves revenues into state-controlled funds rather than trusting it to the sticky fingers of New York and London bankers, as had been the custom since the 1970s when oil prices went through the roof, creating what Henry Kissinger fondly called the petrodollar to replace the gold-backed dollar Washington walked away from on August 15, 1971. The present Sunni-Shiite war, or clash of civilizations, is in fact a result of the U.S. manipulations after 2003 in the region, divide and rule. By 2008, the prospect of sovereign control by a growing number of African and Arab oil states of their state oil and gas revenues was causing serious concern in Wall Street, as well as the City of London. It was hugely liquid in the trillions of dollars they potentially no longer would be controlling, because the African nations would be controlling their own sovereign money. The timing of the Arab Spring, in retrospect, increasingly looks tied to the Washington and Wall Street efforts to control not only the huge Arab Middle East oil flows. It is now clear it was equally aimed at controlling their money, their trillions of dollars accumulating in their new sovereign wealth funds. However, it is now confirmed in the latest Clinton-Blumenthal April 2, 2011 email exchange, there was a quantifiably new threat emerging for Wall Street and the City of London from the African and Arab oil world. Libya's Gaddafi, Tunisia's Ben Ali, Mubarak's Egypt were about to launch a gold-backed Islamic currency independent of the U.S. dollar. It was I was first told of this plan in early 2012 at a Swiss financial and geopolitical conference by an Algerian with extensive knowledge of the project. Documentation was scarce at the time, and the story remained in my mental back burner. Now, a far more interesting picture emerges that puts the ferocity of Washington's Arab Spring and its urgency in the case of Libya into perspective. In 2009, Gaddafi, who was at the time the president of the African Union, had proposed that the economically depressed continent adopt the gold dinar. In the months prior to the U.S. decision, with British and French backing, to get a U.N. Security Council resolution that would give them the legal fig leaf for a NATO destruction of Gaddafi's regime, Gaddafi had been organizing the creation of the gold-backed dinar that would be used by African oil states as well as by Arab OPEC countries in their sales of oil in the world market. Had that happened, at the time Wall Street and the City of London were deep into the financial crisis of 2007-08, the challenge to the reserve currency role of the dollar would have been more than serious. It would have been a death knell to the American financial hegemony and to the dollar system. Africa is one of the world's richest continents with vast unexplored gold and mineral wealth, and had been intentionally kept for centuries undeveloped, underdeveloped, or in wars to prevent their development. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, for the recent decades have been the Washington instruments to suppress African real development. Gaddafi had called upon African oil producers in the African Union and in the Muslim nations to join an alliance that would make the gold dinar their primary form of money in foreign exchange. They would sell oil and other resources to the United States and the rest of the world only for gold. As president of the African Union in 2009, Gaddafi introduced for discussion to the African Union member states Gaddafi's proposal to use the Libyan dinar and the silver dirham as the only possible money for the rest of the world to buy African oil. Along with the Arab OPEC sovereign wealth funds for their oil, other African nations, specifically Angola and Nigeria, were moving to create their own national oil wealth funds at the time of the 2011 NATO bombing of Libya. Those sovereign national wealth funds, tied to Gaddafi's concept of the gold dinar, would make Africa's long-held dream of independence from colonial monetary control, whether the British pound, the French franc, or the euro, or the U.S. dollar, a reality. Gaddafi was moving forward as head of the African Union at the time of his assassination with a plan to unify the sovereign states of Africa with one gold currency. a United States of Africa. In 2004, Pan-American Parliament of 53 nations had laid plans for an African economic community with a single gold currency by 2023. And so, one of the most bizarre features of Hillary Clinton's war to destroy Gaddafi was the fact that the U.S.-backed rebels in Benghazi in the oil-rich eastern part of Libya, in the midst of the battle, well before it was at all clear if they would topple the regime, declared that they had created a Western-style central bank in exile. In the very first weeks of the rebellion, the rebel leaders declared that they had created a central bank to replace Gaddafi's state-owned monetary authority. The rebel council, in addition to creating their own oil company to sell the oil they captured, announced designation of the Central Bank of Benghazi as a monetary authority competent in monetary policies in Libya and appointment of a governor to the central bank. So behind it all was the oligarchs, supporting the oligarchs was Hillary Clinton. So, Michael, take a look at Africa today. Take a look at all of the nations that were once capable of being free of colonialism. So what kind of documentary would you do today if you were to do an honest documentary about the fate of Africans, Libyans in particular, Gaddafi, who posed no threat to America, posed no threat to his citizens, had the highest standard of living of any of the 54 countries, nations in Africa. Women had the most rights of any group in the Muslim world, the most advanced educational system, 98.4% literacy rate. So you're backing a woman who destroyed all that. That's genocide. Think for a moment. Is that what you want to support? Because that's only the beginning. I have a lot more to share with you on upcoming programs. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our program for today. You got me smiling, but I should be ashamed.